Karen Hardglass. Woo! It's time for It's All About Food. And I'm actually in Chicago at the moment. I've been away from New York, where I live, for about 2 months in California. I'm briefly on an overnight little trip here in Chicago. And I'm broadcasting from a hotel, which I'm very glad to be able to do this. It's nice and quiet. But the one thing that I want to ask everyone is, it's about air conditioning. Now, I'm grateful when it's really, really hot to be able to have some air conditioning because it helps you work. It helps you get things done. What I don't understand is, why does it have to be freezing? It's like 91 degrees outside and it's a refrigerator inside. So it's just one of those mysteries of modern life, isn't it? And if anyone has an answer, you can let me know at info@realmeals.org because I would like to know. I'm also grateful that I have a robe to sit in to stay cozy so that I don't catch cold while I'm sitting here. Now, I'm very excited because we have a very interesting guest, and I can't wait to get started talking to him and talking about his newest project. My guest is Joel Helfrich, and he is a father, educator, and activist, and he lives in the city of Rochester near Highland Park. He is an adjunct associate professor of history at Monroe Community College and formerly a visiting assistant professor of environmental studies at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He received his BA in history from the University of Rochester and an M philosophy degree in an MPHIL degree in American studies from the University of Glasgow in Scotland and a PhD in history from the University of Minnesota. His doctoral dissertation is a historical investigation of Western Apache struggles over a sacred and ecologically unique mountain in Arizona from 1871 to 2002. He has also worked on animal rights, environmental, historic, and sacred sites preservation, and social just issues. He holds the conviction, and I love this part of his bio, he holds the conviction that a myopic focus defeats the most important work any historian does, being an informed and informative member of society. He sees the environment as a site where much of his historical training can be brought to bear, so he continues to pursue those interests as well as others. Joel, thank you for joining me today.
No, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, so you contacted me because you wanted to share some information about this new project of yours, the Rochester River School, and I want to hear absolutely everything about it because I've been to the website and it just sounds like the loveliest vision that I could wish for all children who go to school.
So I was fortunate enough, as you said, to teach for a few years as a visiting faculty member at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And one day while I was teaching, I had a student of mine walk into my office and ask me, "What do you know about the Harbor School in New York City?" And I quickly responded that I had never heard of it. And after the student left, and I think that he thought that given my interest in the environment that I would find the school fascinating. So after he left my office, I went online and watched a few videos, and I was floored by the work that they were able to get students to do at this high school, which is located on Governor's Island in New York City. And what finally kind of really drew me in was the fact that Bill Clinton had given a speech at the Harbor School during a fundraiser a number of years ago, and he said two things that really caught my attention. One is he said, "This place is amazing," and two, "The work that's being done at this school should be replicated in every single port city in the world."
Hmm.
So the next time I talked to this student, who was a 2011 valedictorian of the Harbor School, this school that focuses on sustainability-related work and environmental conservation and also maritime work, I flippantly asked the student, "Hey, Rochester, the city of Rochester, New York, where I live, is a port city, it's a river city, it's an Erie Canal city, it's a Finger Lakes city, and it's also a Great Lakes city.
Mm.
And so I said, look, what do you think about the idea of trying to replicate the Harbor School in Rochester? And this was about two and a half years ago, and we basically started to talk to anybody that would listen to us. We talked to business leaders, nonprofit executives, teachers, parents, several superintendents, and basically what we realized was that trying to start a high school in Rochester, New York would be a nearly impossible feat given the number of problems that we have in our community. Rochester, New York has a really low graduation rate, the worst in New York State. It, at times, has had the worst graduation rate for African-American male students and the worst graduation for Latino students in the country at 9 and 10% respectively. We have tremendous amounts of poverty in Rochester. According to recent studies in the last year, we have the highest rates of extreme poverty for a city of our size in the U.S. And we also have extremely terrible birth rates for teenage pregnant women. So all of those kind of statistics, coupled with the fact that we have a 70% rate of trauma among our student population in the city, made us realize that trying to start a high school level, start at the high school level, where students at ninth grade might be five grade levels behind in reading, writing, and math, would be a non-starter. So we shifted gears, and we, for a time, thought we were going to start a 5-12 school. And within the last 6 months, our board for this nonprofit we've created called the Rochester River Foundation, which would be the mission-supporting and financial-supporting arm of the Rochester River School, has decided to go with a K-12 model. So we will start with kindergarten and basically add a grade each year until it's ultimately a K-12 school. We've also changed the focus a little bit so that instead of, you know, focusing strictly on maritime education and so forth, we're going with a humane education focus. So we will look at issues of human rights, environmental stewardship, animal ethics, and also cultural issues with the goal of trying to create what are called solutionaries. So we want to have active students who are doers, who are trying to create a lot more good and a lot less harm, trying to combat justice, trying to combat injustice with justice. And we also are proposing to be the first vegan public school in the country, and that has gotten us a little bit of attention as well.
Well, that got my attention.
So it's been an uphill battle. We initially thought for 2 years that we were going to be a district school, and we couldn't find a champion for our school in the district, given the number of problems that the district faces. And we've decided to pursue a charter route. So we will, as soon as we can raise the funding to get our application in order, we will be applying to the state to get a charter.
And I'm not that familiar with the different designations of schools. So what does that mean if you have a charter?
So charter schools are public schools. The difference is that we will, instead of having our school run by a school district, we will have our school run by a school board, as well as the head of school. And so there's some people that don't like charters, and there's some people that are really champions for charters. We are thinking that we're doing enough things that are different, that, you know, we're hoping that people embrace our school. And in fact, that seems to be the case. That's what we've found, is that people are actually not only saying that there's a need for our school in the district, but they're actually demanding that our school open. And so we recently completed an online community survey of more than 500 individuals, and about 60% of those individuals were folks who lived in the city, many of whom have children. And we have people saying in the district that we want the school to open, we want to send our children to your school. And we even get people from outside the district saying, look, if you open your school, we will move into the city in order to send our children to your school.
Now, aside from cost, are there other obstacles to making this happen?
I mean, really, the biggest obstacle is that, you know, we the most recent charter applications that have been approved in New York State that I've looked at are pretty lengthy, so between 500 and 600 pages. And so it's a pretty massive undertaking, a pretty heavy lift. And so we have decided that there are some contractors and some consultants that we would like to hire, people that have basically done this work time and again, and so that we don't have to replicate the wheel, or we don't have to, you know, try and figure out how best to present the school to the state. We will work with some consultants and write the application. So right now we are facing the challenge of trying to raise what we've figured out is about $50,000, and we will be launching a crowdfunding campaign soon on CrowdRise. And should we be able to raise that money, we will immediately start working on writing our application and hopefully get that before the SUNY, the State University of New York, at the next available opportunity, hopefully before the end of the year.
So the CrowdRise hasn't started yet?
We haven't. We're probably about a week away from launching that campaign.
Okay. Now, we are in some troubled times. And I mean, that's that's mild. And I like Facebook, for example, for sharing happy stories and pictures of families and friends and people I haven't seen in a while. But it's changed, and it's just one example of what's going on in this country and in our hearts because of all the violence and horror and hatred that's going on. It's so overwhelming. Nobody likes it. People are polarized and taking sides, and it seems so hopeless. And then I read about a project like yours, and I think, yeah, this is it. This is what we need. We need to be refocusing all of our attention on all of these good issues, these right issues, and educating our young children on social issues and ecosystem issues, the environment, and eating healthy, delicious food. This is where it should be. So I was just like, was able to breathe. Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Joel.
No, I mean, it's not just me. I mean, there's a bunch of great people that are working on this. And, you know, we are trying to create these solutionaries, these children who are going to try to figure out how to solve some of these huge problems, whether it's, like you said, violence or, you know, climate change or poverty and various forms of inequality. There's no reason to believe that, you know, children can't be working on trying to find solutions to all the myriad of problems that, you know, we've just raised. And we think that, you know, knowing where your food comes from, helping to grow food, helping to basically eat really healthy and nutritious food that's plant-based, you know, we firmly believe that that's the best thing for the environment and from a sustainability perspective. We feel that it's obviously the best thing for the animals. And then in terms of human health and lastly, social justice, you know, we've been really, I don't want to say surprised by the support, especially for that aspect of the school and the vegan ethic that we're putting forth. But it's been really empowering to recognize that there's a lot of great people out there who are doing great work and who support, you know, this idea. So we hope to be one of a number of people in a number of schools nationally and hopefully globally that adopt similar policies.
Yourself and the other people that are developing this program, are you students of Zoe Weil's Humane Education Program, since this is based on the principles of humane education?
Definitely. We actually, in 2014, when we started thinking about our school, the Institute for Humane Education at that time was planning to create what they were calling a solutionary school in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of our first things that we did was we invited Zoe Weil from the Institute for Humane Education to Rochester, and we hosted a workshop and basically kind of introduced the city of Rochester to these principles of humane education. And that, you know, that was a great first step. So, yeah, we've been working with the Institute, and they have they are supporting the work that we're doing and have been very helpful, obviously, as you mentioned, with social media. And we expect to have a stronger relationship in the future. And furthermore, we also expect that, you know, a lot of the teachers that they've helped to create in the last decade or two, that some of those teachers might come to Rochester and be some of the early teachers for our school.
This concept of solutionaries is so critical for our children, because so many of them hear what's going on in the world today. It's really hard to be a child today and be sheltered from everything that's going around, and not be affected by it and not feel that things are hopeless. And this concept, maybe you could talk a little bit more about the concept behind solutionaries and empowering these young people to know that they can make a difference.
I mean, I think that you said it best. I mean, I think that it's extremely important, and it's possible. You know, if we do what Thoreau said about, you know, that he said there's 1,000 people that are striking at the branches of, you know, injustice in our world, but there's only really one that's, you know, striking at the roots. And a lot of people believe that one issue is education. You know, we think that if we are really going to try to strive for any kind of sustainability, or better still, some sort of thrivability, that we need solutionaries, you know, young people who have basically been taught to solve problems in strategic and comprehensive ways, and that are going to look to do the most good and the least harm. And that could be, again, to themselves, it could be to other people, it could be to other species or the environment. And, you know, that's the real focus of our school, is to create generations of solutionaries. And that's a concept that's really catching on in terms of the animal rights and liberation communities, in terms of human rights communities. And we hope to be a part of that, you know, larger process and effort.
Do you have an idea of what a day in the life of a child going to your school would be like?
Well, you know, we're going to have some of the more traditional things that you could think of, you know, the reading, writing, and math. But we also hope to get kids outside on a daily basis. And at least one day a week, we hope to get them on the river. So we have a river called the Genesee River. It actually flows right through the city of Rochester. And there are actually 2 or 3 falls that go as you go through the city. One of which is, you know, 100 or 100 plus feet, maybe even more than that. And so we hope to get these children on the river and experiencing the river and doing either soil or testing or water testing, hydrogeology projects. They could do ecological journaling and different biology work. And then we also want to have our children and these students growing their own food for the school. So the ultimate goal would be to have the food that is served to students be food that they have themselves grown and harvested and cleaned and prepared, and maybe even get to a point where we could send food home to children. So we know that a good portion of our kids are going to come to school either hungry because they haven't eaten in a long time, or they're going to come to school having eaten food that's really not nutritious or anything close to nutritious. And so we really think it's important that, you know, these students learn how to grow their own food, share that knowledge with their family and community, and then eat the food that they've prepared. So, you know, I'm not a K-12 educator. You know, and a lot of these details have got to be worked out. But, you know, I do see that our kids are going to be outside really trying to take on that thing called the nature deficit disorder. So getting kids reconnected with the outdoors and, given that humans spend most of their time indoors and we think that there's tremendous benefits of getting them outside, we will certainly be doing that.
This sounds a lot better than Pokemon Go to get kids outdoors.
you're probably onto something. That's right. Definitely.
Now, Rochester. Rochester was a great city was thriving at one point, and it's just so sad to see how it has just gone down into such poverty. Kodak was there, and a lot of the early semiconductor industry technology got started there with the film industry, and it's just a very different place now. And as you mentioned, when we first started, the intersection of so many great bodies of water, it really is meant to be a thriving metropolis.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Rochester was the United States' first boom town, arguably, or at least, not on the coast boom town, I should say, inland boom town. And it really was hopping. It still is to a great extent. We've just replaced certain industries with others, but you're exactly right. Kodak, Xerox, and Bausch & Lomb, that kind of triad of industry. We are an old Rust Belt city. We were at one point during the early years of the 19th century, the world's producer of flour products, of flour milling industries. And then for a good portion of time, we were also the flower city. So we had the world's largest nursery in Rochester, New York.
Wow. I would never know that.
Yeah. We also were one of four complete Frederick Law Olmsted designed park systems in the United States, the other three being Louisville, Boston, and Buffalo. So there's a lot of amazing resources and things that have happened here. Susan B. Anthony's home is here. Frederick Douglass, spent the largest portion of his life in Rochester and published a number of newspapers out of Rochester. So there's this amazing legacy and assets that have been to a great extent and arguably untapped. So we have a number of people who are finally recognizing here in the 21st century that, for example, this body of water that runs through the city. Well, the city, turned its back on that river for a long time, and our elected officials and other people are finally recognizing that we need to return to the river and return to this this place and really try and reconnect with this place. So we think that our school will be not the kind of answer to all the problems that we've talked about, but we can be part of the solution to the various problems that our city faces. And there's a lot of great things that are going on here. We've got a lot of great people and some really wonderful businesses, and so we're going to be part of that, I hope.
It seems, and I've read this a lot, where the most creativity seems to come out of misfortune. And I don't recommend misfortune to anyone or poverty or anything, but no. That's when we dig deep and come up right. with our greatest ideas.
No, I think that's right. We're just part of this larger effort to try to figure out how to, deal with the complex problems that our local community faces and that, the United States and the people on this earth face. So we're just going to try and do our little part and, hopefully get to a point where we've got students that graduate from the river school and continue to do great things.
Okay, let's talk about plant-based foods, because this program is called It's All About Food. We don't always talk about food on this show, but most of the time we do. It's my favorite subject. Excuse me. You mentioned to me that you've been vegan since 2000?
That's correct, yep.
Yeah, what was your epiphany?
Oh, boy. There were a couple of stages in my life where I, you know, thought differently about food. One was when I was in high school, I was dating someone who had given up pork products for Lent. And when Lent ended, you know, I stopped eating pork products just in a sign of solidarity. And once Lent ended, my partner at the time, she went back to eating pork-based products, and I never ate them again. Then in college, I, again, was dating someone, and I became a vegetarian, not entirely because of them, but because I started thinking about the ways in which my diet affected animals. And then probably the largest epiphany happened when I was teaching at the University of Minnesota. I was teaching an English composition course based on the environment, and I had a student who was vegan, and she did a presentation that dealt with factory farming and animal rights and slaughterhouses. And she didn't, you know, point to me and say, hey, why aren't you a vegan? But her presentation made me think about how many inconsistencies and maybe even contradictions I had in my own life. So I was still drinking milk and still eating dairy products and so forth and eggs. And I spent about a week really kind of grappling with the issues that she had raised in her presentation that, again, weren't directed to me, but got me thinking. And so about a week went by, and I woke up and I had my kind of traditional standard American diet breakfast. It was predominantly milk-based, and I basically threw up several times, and for that afternoon, I stopped eating any dairy products, and I was on a high for about 2 or 3 days. I felt wonderful, like I had kind of purged stuff out of my system. And I had grown up in a place just outside of Rochester where there was a dairy, and I would go to that dairy once I learned how to drive, and I would come back with gallons of milk and glass bottles. And every time I would drive home, you know, either a grandmother or some older parent would roll down their window and say, you know, it's great to see somebody drinking milk, because I would drink it on the way home. And, you know, I kind of cringe at that now, but I basically just said, I'm not going to, you know, do this anymore. And a few days later, I gave away my leather boots and my belt and my wallet, and I haven't turned back since, and I have no intention of doing so. In fact, the vegan aspect of the school was the only non-negotiable when we started doing this work, my co-founder and I. I said, you know, we can change things, we can modify things, we can, you know, do different projects. We thought we were creating a high school, but now we're creating a K-12 school. So we're open and flexible, but on this issue of kind of plant-based diet, We feel like we can't teach our children about humane education while simultaneously serving them meat, dairy, and eggs.
This is beautiful. Good for you. Stick to it. I really have great respect for that. Children should be taught the truth, and children should be taught as much as possible to live without hypocrisy, which is really hard for us.
No, I agree. I mean, I've seen it in my own family. You know, my daughter is vegetarian when she's with her mom, and she's vegan when she's with me. But I've seen it where some of my nieces and nephews. I remember distinctly a time when my niece was, I don't know, 3 years old or so, and she had somehow figured out that, you know, the pork on her plate had come from a pig.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother and I think my parents possibly and my sister-in-law basically kind of convinced her that it was okay for her to eat that, even though she had in her, you know, really brilliance figured out that she didn't want to eat that food that had come from an animal. And I've seen this time and again. My neighbors have done the same thing. Friends have done the same thing with their children. And it really kind of, to me, knocks down these creative individuals who inherently know better and don't want to eat the food, but we have you know, these socially constructed desires that tell us that, oh, it's okay to eat these foods. And I don't know, I just have a problem with that.
We do it with everything. We do it with food. It's very apparent as vegans to know how people do this with food, but society does it with so many things.
Oh, sure.
The way we mold children to our thoughts of what's right and what's wrong.
Sure. It could be about, you know, celebrating Christopher Columbus.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know,
there's our history right there. We had our own Holocaust right here in the United States.
Right.
And we celebrate it in a twisted way. But I think that's changing a little bit.
No, it is.
Slowly.
All this is. I mean, even here in Rochester, the PCRM came to town and had a number of, you know, rather well-known physicians come through the city in the last 4 or 5 months through an organization in Rochester called Rochester Area Vegan Society, which has been around for maybe 25, 40, 30, maybe 35 years, I'm not sure. And we did the 21-day, you know, vegan challenge.
The Kickstart,
yeah. Your health. And the mayor issued a proclamation in support of that. And, you know, so there are more people who are thinking about the food that they're putting into their bodies. And we've had a number of great vegan restaurants in Rochester come online in the last few years, really amazing vegan restaurants, actually. We've seen a lot more bakeries and cupcake shops that have said, well, we're at least going to be half vegan, if not fully vegan. So, you know, people are...
Is that like being half pregnant? No, I know what it means.
No, or I'm only going to eat, you know, vegan stuff one day of the week or whatever. But, no, people are at least thinking more about it, and
yes,
they're more aware of it.
I told you that I really liked this piece in your bio, and I thought maybe we could talk about it a little bit. Your conviction that a myopic focus defeats the most important work any historian does.
Well, I'm kind of a jack of all trades. I mean, the last 2 years have been a huge kind of learning curve for me, trying to understand a huge amount of issues regarding K-12 education. And I try to follow my passions, I guess, is the bottom line. And so that's led me in a number of directions over the years, that to doing things that many people might think are unrelated. So, for example, I, you know, worked with a number of Western Apaches in Arizona to try to get the University of Minnesota and the University of Virginia not to buy into a telescope project on a sacred and ecologically unique mountain. I've tried to, in a number of cities, save really unique historic properties. I've been a part of efforts to protest any number of issues regarding indigenous peoples and their rights, or animal rights and liberation issues. So, you know, all these things don't look like they're together, but I try to just, you know, follow my passions and try to, you know, be a good person as best I can.
Well, we've been taught a certain history, a certain story, and the story is different based on the storyteller. I love the People's History of the United States as an example.
Right.
It was a very different history of the United States than I learned when I was in school, and I hope children today are learning a more varied history with different perspectives, because the history from the perspective of the victor is very different than the history from the perspective of those who've been exploited.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, coming back to just Christopher Columbus for a minute, you know, I have a lot of trouble with people who say, well, you know, this is the way we should teach this history. And I believe that we should teach about Christopher Columbus, but it shouldn't be to glorify. And I think that we can teach little children in an age-appropriate manner the kind of person that Christopher Columbus was. Here you have an individual who was really part of a first wave of enslaving indigenous peoples in the Americas, who bragged about, you know, sharpening his knives on the back of indigenous peoples, who was really in charge of a lot of violence against native peoples here and against his own crew, for that matter. I mean, he had offered a reward to the first person on his ships to see land, and when I can't remember who it was, but one of the guys on the ship said, "Hey, there's land." Christopher Columbus, in order to collect the reward, said, "Well, no, actually, I saw land, you know, several hours ago." We at least need to interrogate this history a little bit, and you know, what is the harm in saying that Christopher Columbus was a bad guy? You know, we can't imagine somebody talking about Hitler and saying, "Well, you know, he was a kind of second-rate artist, and he had mm-hmm. the ability to really instill a great amount of loyalty by his words and his ability to move people and his public kind of perception and so forth." I mean, is that what we're going to talk about, or can we tell a little child that, you know, this is not a good person? To me, that is being more honest than simply saying, well, you know, we've named a national holiday after him, so we need to, you know, teach that he's a great person.
I think we'd do a lot better solving today's problems if we didn't have this ego attached to history that wasn't even real. This "Make America Great Again" thing. We're just human beings, and we're the same as everyone all over the planet. We all want clean air to breathe and clean water to drink and healthy food for our families, a home to live in.
That's right.
We all want the same things. It's not about being better or worse.
Right. Yeah. No, I haven't even tried to figure out how to unpack that expression, but
yeah.
But I do think that, you know, we would do better to, you know, try to work together. You know, whenever anybody talks about our school, I say, look, we are interested in collaboration and cooperation. We know, and there have been a number of studies that have suggested in the last few years that even sports teams are often better when they're working on cooperation rather than competition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that there is tremendous benefit, and I think maybe even going back to history, there's some huge cases and examples where, you know, cooperation has borne amazing results over trying to compete with each other for resources or knowledge or, you know, what have you, or land, especially land.
Well, cooperation is really important, and it's also changing the way we look at our ancestors, archaeologists, anthropologists, all those folks who are studying history from a really long time ago and had all kinds of assumptions of us being aggressive hunters, and now starting to come up with new theories that it was cooperation that really enabled us to move forward and advance.
Right. You know, Neil Barnard said something, rather, when he was in Rochester, that the head of PCRM, he said something to the effect of that, you know, he had been inquiring with, I don't think it was Richard Leakey, but one of the Leakey family members about, you know, the meat consumption among Neanderthals and so forth. And the reaction was that, you know, they were not these big meat eaters that we've made them out to be. I've been meaning to follow up with Dr. Barnard about that, but I think that we would be smart to, like you said, let go of our ego and recognize that we don't know everything, and there's still so much about this earth, about this planet, you know, let alone outer space or the deepest parts of our oceans, that, you know, things that we simply don't know, and we would be smart to acknowledge that and bring forth a lot more humility and a lot more compassion. Certainly empathy would be great, but, you know, really focusing on compassion and humility would be wonderful.
Would really be wonderful. Would really be wonderful. Let's just put that out there to the universe. The Rochester River School, how do we stay in touch with you and find out when this CrowdRise project is starting, and how can people find out more? Do they just go to your website?
Well, definitely. If people go to our website, which is rochesterriverschool.org, there's a link on that site to our Facebook page. We're trying to get, you know, people to like our Facebook page, which obviously, you know, shows a little bit of support. But as long as they are connected up with us through Facebook, we can then let people know, hopefully in the next week or so, when we've launched this fundraising effort. And there'll be there's updates on that. There's updates on our website. And then if people want to email me directly, they can reach me at info@rochesterriverschool.org, and that's all one word. And, you know, anybody can write to me. You don't have to have children, and you don't have to live in Rochester to reach out. So, you know, wherever, you know, listeners are and they want to contact us, we would love to hear from them.
That's nice. I was just smiling when you were mentioning your Facebook page. It seems like the beginning of this interview and towards the end, we're beginning and ending with Facebook. it's really a very important place, whether you like Facebook or not. There's a lot of life there, and we can use it for good if we choose to.
No, I agree. Well, I don't have I don't have my own Facebook page, but you know, I've seen the benefits of it, and you know, we've just within the last year we've connected with people through Facebook for the school, and in my own life with people I know, I've helped to rescue animals actually through Facebook. So I completely agree.
Okay, Joel, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you.
You're welcome, and thanks for inviting me.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Joel Helfrich, everyone, of the Rochester River School. And I'll mention the website again, rochesterriverschool.org. Just go there, okay, and read their vision, their mission. I think it'll make you feel good. It made me feel good. And we need to be feeling good, because there's so many things out there that make us feel not so good. We just have a few minutes left, and I just wanted to talk about a number of different things. So here's something that I hope will make you feel good. You know Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn and his son Rip Esselstyn, his daughter Jane Esselstyn, his wife Anne Cryle Esselstyn. They have been working tirelessly for a long time promoting plant-based foods. Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn has a wonderful book, Prevent Heart Disease. I've interviewed him and Rip Esselstyn and Anne and Jane, and they're all very lovely people. Well, they have events going on, and I want to let you know about them, because if you want to mingle and schmooze with these wonderful people and a lot of other great folks that are promoting this plant-based message that we all love or want to find out more about, these events are going on. They have these weekend events in Dallas, Cleveland, and Pasadena, and they also have a week-long retreat in October in Sedona, and I've got some discount codes for you. So if you were interested in the weekend pass, if you use the code REAL50, REAL50, you get a $50 off the cost of the weekend pass. And if you want to go to the retreat, use the code REAL150, REAL150, and you get a $150 discount. I'm really happy to be able to promote these events and share these discounts with you. You can go to responsibilityandliving.com. We have it advertised on our homepage. They're called Two Forks Events. So that's the number two, Forks Events. And their website is tworksevents.com. That could be a lot of fun. meeting and greeting. When I first started getting involved in my advocacy for vegan food, I went to as many events as I could. Now, this was a long time ago, and that meant there weren't many events. So I thought I was going to all of them because there weren't that many. And then I started to organize dinner lectures in New York, and we had a very large all-vegan festival in Manhattan called the Taste of Health from, 2002 to 2006. I think it was the biggest vegan festival at the time, maybe even ever. We had about 10,000 people moving into that festival. But the vegetarian vegan festivals now are just so much better because there are many more products, many more people involved, many more businesses, and lots of information to share, so many videos and books. It's just a wealth. And you can get it all online. And I'm glad you're listening here to my program, which is available for free online for anyone. But there's nothing better than meeting people face to face. And that's this kind of disconnect we have because of the internet, thanks to the internet, at the cost of the internet, where we spend so much time looking at a screen, learning, but we're missing that human interaction, which is really what we're supposed to be doing, and feels really good when we share nice moments with people. And so events like these are really great because the food's going to be fabulous. You know, it's going to be clean. It's going to be all plant foods. It's blessed by Caldwell Esselstyn, a medical doctor, and Rip Esselstyn, too, who is really good with food. He has a number of books out with lots of recipes, of course. Manly food, food for manly men, right? He was a firefighter. For people that want to be strong, not just men, of course, I'm being silly, but for a long time, this diet, this vegan diet, plant-based diet, was thought not to be adequate for people to build muscles and was thought to be kind of a weakling, a diet for weaklings in a way. And now we're seeing that that is so not true. Many, many athletes are moving towards eating plants. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger, if you haven't read that, has given up eating meat, and he's actually working with the Chinese to help them cut their meat intake in half, I think by 2030, maybe. I may get that wrong. Or maybe right. So that's that program, those events, the real code, REAL50 for $50 off for the weekend, and REAL150 for the retreat. I hope you use it. Another thing I wanted to talk about briefly is I just published an article on the Responsible Eating and Living page. It's something I've been working on for years. I've titled it The Cancer Diagnosis, Taking Charge of Your Health and Healing. When people used to contact me about cancer and what I did to heal from cancer, I would send them a version of this article, and I've worked on it for a long time, as I've mentioned, and I'm finally very happy that I posted it and I've shared it. Many people have been reading it and commenting about it, and I want you to know about it. You can read it, you can download it, you can share it. There's a lot of great information in there and links to resources that can be helpful to people who get a cancer diagnosis, which is one of the more scary things that can happen to us in life. We all know we're going to die, but it would be ideal if we could live a long, happy, healthy, quality life for, I said a long time, but long, like however long you want to live. And then when you're tired, you just go to sleep and move on to the next phase, whatever that is. But cancer diagnosis, that's like a very bad kick in the gut and scary. And I like, rather than inflicting fear, which happens a lot today by our government and by our society, scaring us into doing things, I like inspiring hope And there's so much that you can do as an individual to prevent cancer and to bounce back from it if it happens to get a little aggressive in your body. And a lot of it, our conventional medical community doesn't know about, so they can't share it. And that's one good thing about the internet. So please visit and read the cancer diagnosis, and please share it. And again, if you want to know more, you can always email me, just like Joel was saying. He's happy to engage with anyone, and he shared with his email. I do the same thing, info@realmeals.org. Please, if you have any questions, comments, I want to hear about them. We have, maybe 4 minutes left. I wanted to tell you that I am eating chia seeds. Okay, the show is called It's All About Food, so I like to talk about food. And it's not that I never had chia seeds before. I've had some chia puddings that my friends have made. I've never really liked them. I'm sure I've had them in different things, but I've always opted at home to buy flax seeds. The primary reason is flax seeds are a lot cheaper. And from what I've read, they're pretty even in terms of the omega-3 fatty acids that you can get from them. So I stuck with flax seeds, and I've been using them for a very, very long time and very happy with them. But as I mentioned, I've been in California for 2 months. We're actually going to be California for another month before heading back to New York. And I don't have all of my pantry of staples that I love. And I love to prepare food and cook food. And so it's been a little frustrating when we don't have the tools and the space that we like to have to prepare meals. And we were in a store, and I saw a bag of chia seeds there, and I knew that I hadn't been eating my flax seeds because I didn't have a good blender or a spice grinder to grind flax seeds. And as you know, when we eat flax seeds, it's best to buy them whole because they will be fresh. They don't really go bad as a whole seed for a long time. And then we need to grind them because we can't digest them whole. They have to be ground. And you need a really sharp blade to grind those things. Those shells are tough. And a good spice grinder, coffee grinder, is what I use to grind my flax seeds. And I didn't have anything to do that here. And when I saw the chia seeds, and they weren't that expensive, I knew that I didn't have to grind them. So I thought, get the chia seeds. And for the last 2 weeks, I've been enjoying them. I've been putting them in my oats, my rolled oats, my steel-cut oats. And I know that they should be soaked, and they're very easy to soak. They plump up and soften up very quickly once you put them in water. Even eating them plain, they have a nice little crunch like a Rice Krispies or something. So I've been enjoying my chia experience. Yes, we just have a couple of minutes left now, and I had a few things that I wanted to bring up, and I don't want to end on a sour note, but I want to inspire everybody to please contact your representatives in Congress. We have that DARK Act, and we thought it was done, but it's still happening. The Senate recently approved a version of the DARK Act, and that's to get GMO labeling kind of watered down. And there's a bit in this legislation where they want to use a QR code, the quick response code, a barcode that would be on the label. So you can't read it, but your smartphone can read it. And that means you need to have a smartphone. And that's not a good thing because people don't have smartphones. It's not convenient. And I'm thinking to myself, would any person that's selling a food product, would they not tell you what the food is? Would they not say, you have to know that on the label, it'll say what it is. It'll say it's milk or it's chocolate or it's candy or something. A distributor isn't going to want to put a barcode for what the food is because they know people aren't going to know what it is. And that's why they want to use this kind of code to say that their item is GMO, because they don't want people to know. And that's why this legislation is bad. So if you have a chance to contact your representatives and tell them to vote this down, we keep doing it, and Congress keeps throwing it back. It's not a good thing. And that's your assignment for today or tomorrow, okay? And that's it. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Email me at info@realmeals.org. And please have a delicious week. Bye-bye.